Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak to a photographer about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. Or at least, that's the plan. I have noticed recently I'm talking maybe a bit less about lenses, which I guess means that what I've been saying for a while is true, that the show is not so much about gear, it's more about making things, and the gear was an excuse for a conversation. Anyway, my guest this week is Stasia Schmidt, and we do talk about lenses a bit. And it's a lovely conversation because I like it when the guest gets involved and kind of interviews me a little bit as well. Stasia lives in Canada. She's a fine art photographer. She's my first fine art photographer interviewee and makes incredible photographs and has been recognized recently by Leica. She's one of these annoying people who has picked up a camera very, very recently and is just incredibly good at it very fast. So I think you'll really enjoy this conversation with Stasia about moving from Canon to Leica, about photographing in Canada, and about being brave enough to sit in very cold water to get the photo that's in your head and make it real. So here's my conversation with Stasia. My challenge is that I have two kids, and one is worried about what his parents think, and one is not.
Yes, that also happens. Yeah.
So, Lewis is brilliant. He's a rule follower, and he's much more patient and much calmer, whereas Ben's a little firecracker. So, do you have a couple or one? Or
I have two daughters. They are 16 and 14. Mm. So we're kind of past that phase that you're describing, but it just manifests itself in teenagehood, where the first daughter is very studious and kind of, you know, likes to understand boundaries and how to work within those to be successful and et cetera. She reads a lot. And then the second one is, more of that firecracker kind of. Keeps us on our toes.
1,000%. I feel like, you know, if he doesn't become a performer of some sort, I think the world will be missing out. He's hilarious. But they're both brilliant different ways. And Lewis is going to do other stuff. Anyway, I digress. But yes, it's wonderful to talk to you.
It's so nice to talk to you too, Ian.
I've been really admiring your stuff. You're also, though, I've been looking at your work and really enjoying it because you're the first fine art photographer that I've spoken to as part of these interviews.
Oh, okay. Well, what type of photographers are you usually speaking to?
Well, it's a mix. So it's a lot of people who either talk about photography a lot. So they may not be professional photographers. They're often like YouTube type people who review cameras and handle cameras a lot or enjoy them for their quality, but maybe photography isn't their full-time gig. We've had woodland photographers, which is maybe the closest potentially, because you're finding form and story and things within a scene. And then there's also the kind of more often than not as well, the jobbing photographers, right? You're like, I have to do the thing I do. So I'm a wedding photographer, or I'm asked to photograph, you know, I do 100 portraits for a thing. Or there was Rob, who was an early interview guest, who was a MotoGP photographer, which was really cool. So completely, but as much, I mean, Rob's photos, I want to talk to him because he's amazing, because his stuff, they look like paintings, like they're incredible. He takes these very hard-edged, clinical, saturated, but like very hard things, machines, and he does make them look phenomenal. Like it's just in a very painterly and creative kind of way.
Yeah.
So, but they are dealing with, even if they have concepts and ideas for things, they are dealing with the thing that is kind of in front of them. Mm-hmm. And so seeing your stuff, I studied art up until sort of my late teens, kind of early 20s, and I've always loved painting, go to museums and look at art. And so seeing your photographs and the way that there's a real bleed and overlap between maybe how you think about your work potentially, I think, is like a painter, you know, like you've talked about having ideas for like your one of the photos you've took recently of like the person in the water with the trees around them, was it drowning?
That was actually a few years ago in the fall, and that's a self-portrait.
Ah, okay. So there you go.
I set my camera up, and I had all the beta on when the leaves were going to turn, and water level goes up and down depending on the season. Mm-hmm. So I needed to know when those trees were going to be in the water, and I had kind of scouted the shoreline and figured out, okay, so this tunnel, that, and when the light is going to be right here at about 4:30 p.m. coming over the coming over the mountain, then it's going to hit just right in that corridor.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I just had the camera set up with the intervalometer and just got in there. It's freezing. Yeah. It's glacier water. It's
really cold. I was going to ask if it was you. Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah. Wow. That's an amazing thing. How long do these ideas sit with you for a long time generally, or do you kind of have them and then have to execute them quite quickly?
This was an idea that is a bit of a famous spot in Western Canada to shoot. Everyone loves to shoot these drowned aspens. And it is truly very beautiful, but I just wanted to create kind of a different sort of scene and a feeling within that popular spot to shoot. And so the easiest thing I could come up with is to insert myself into the scene, but not make it about myself, just make it about this figure. And so I think I sat on that one for about a month. The other series, like the one that did so well with Leica, that was a 2-year project of trying to figure out how to insert this surreal element into these settings that I find myself in, that I'm really drawn to. So,
yes. Was that Ephemerality?
Yes.
Is that the collection? Yes. Love those images.
Thank you.
When I was reading your sort of some of your bio and your background, you were saying about being influenced by science fiction. I was like, yes, they've got really big alien Prometheus kind of energy and tone. Were they local to you, those photos? Or
So those photos were actually from all over the world. So Greenland, the Rockies here for sure, Mongolia. And I feel like I'm done with that series. But yeah, I hauled all that fabric around for about 2 years everywhere I went.
Right.
And to see what I could create in the moment when I was out there.
Yeah. No, it's really wonderful to see a different tone. Like for me personally, to look at a different tone of image, different type of image. It's like completely different. It's not relying on like the story and a subject. You're instead you have something, I think it sounds like, you want to create. Do you sketch them out first, or do you just have them in your head? Or
I just have them in my head. I mean, I have immersed myself in so much science fiction and fantasy since growing up. So I'm constantly trying to, it's just my creative brain is always thinking of new ideas, and sometimes I'll sit on them for a while. I have some upcoming ideas that I would like to kind of try and start experimenting with. I don't really think of myself as a landscape photographer, even though I'm out with landscape photographers sometimes and we're shooting the same thing, but I want to try and find something more within the scene, if that makes sense. Like just to create a different type of story within the landscape. That's what interests me personally.
There's immediately, I think, a story in your imagery. I recently spoke to a woodland photographer. I know a guy called Simon Baxter, and I've spoken to some landscape photographers. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Like Simon's thing is very much, he wants his photos to look like as if you were there.
So right.
Very purposely setting things up. He's not going down low. He's not going up high. He's not staging. You know, he's got very strict rules for himself about moving things out of the way. Mm-hmm. That feels like kind of the opposite for you, I guess, where you're, you know, it's artifice on purpose almost, like,
absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't really move the elements around so much. So, I think on that, with the figure floating in the water, I think there was a willow branch I tied back with a strap, a ski strap, I think I had in my camera bag. It's not like I can move a glacier around or lift huge rocks, but, introducing an element of like that mystery or that surrealism, that's what excites me. And it's not going to be like somebody could go to that same spot and you wouldn't know that that's where I was shooting, because I'm trying to set my camera in such a way in order to usually fill the frame or to, it's a very creative process for me.
Yeah. Does it come from your love of science fiction? Was it like reading? Was it book-based? Because it feels like if you're doing a lot of this stuff in your head, that maybe you've experienced a lot through reading, that you're used to creating images in your mind.
Yeah, it's very book based. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the best science fiction really is like,
it's absolutely.
In so few words, tells you. It's why I found some writing, because I studied literature at university, and it's why I found some writing that gets that, we know, like things like Gormenghast, that just go into such incredible detail about every scene and tell you, and can we just get to the bit where you like, I'm impressed that you've thought about everything. It's almost like they don't trust the reader to fill in any gaps. It's why I could never read the Da Vinci Code, because at the beginning of, I think, the third chapter, when he's describing driving a Citroen down the Champs-Élysées, and I was like, this is just too much. Like, just stop it. I just, can we let the story
happen? Respect my intelligence a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just fill in the gap a bit. Yeah. You know? just a little bit. But people love it. What are you going to do?
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
No, that's really cool. And I love the color and the tone, I think, of those images. There's a consistency across them, even if they're all in different places. I think that's that also, I joke sometimes on the podcast, like, I'm a tourist. Like, I love photography, but I don't have the burden of it being my job. And and my creative outlet is like talking to photographers and enjoying photography. Mm-hmm. But that consistency must be, and doing it for a few years, it sounds like you didn't know how many you were going to make at the beginning of that process. You just sort of knew that you wanted to, and then did they keep popping into your head through the course of that process?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like working with color in post. Mm. I think it's very interesting. I enjoy it. Mm. And seeing, you know, how can I use color to reinforce the story that I'm trying to tell? Yeah. And that's a fascinating process for me. Color's fun.
Color is fun. I've been enjoying, obviously I love color. I'm, for the listeners, wearing a ridiculous orange sweater. it's my favorite color. A lot of my life is orange. I recently read the Joel Meyerowitz book on A Question of Color, which I'd been going through a phase of shooting lots of black and white. I'm really enjoying it. I was like, maybe I could just shoot black and white. Maybe I could be one of those madmen who owns a monochrome camera, you know, just rule it out. And then it was like reading one of those books that you read when you're trying to give up smoking or something. By the end of the book, I was just like, oh no. It was on a flight. It's quite a short book. And you can
I'll have to pick it up.
It's really interesting. So my stepdad might be next door reading it right now, because I'm trying to get him to look at it. But it was one of those moments where I started the flight, opened the book, and by the end of the flight, I was just like, right, well, it's going to be hard to justify black and white now, because he shot color and black and white side by side on film in like the 60s and 70s, I want to say. And it's just so interesting, because you don't ever see those sorts of things side by side. Like what you're talking about, the post-processing, is a very personal sort of inward process that we don't often share until we've arrived at the moment at the end. Like when you're approaching your color work, how long do you give yourself to kind of...
Oh, that's a really good question. Sometimes I can finish an image in 45 minutes, and sometimes it'll take a month simply because I'll... you know, do a couple things and something's not quite right, but I can't figure out what it is. So I need to give myself some time to let it marinate, to think about what I want it to be.
Yeah.
So yeah, it takes time. And that's actually one of the interesting things I've noticed about moving from my Canon system to the Leica system is the colors are so different. Mm-hmm. And when I first started shooting with the Leica a couple months ago, and I would just go through the same process as with the color. And it's like, this is terrible. What am I doing? It was a disaster. I had to completely relearn how to use color within the Leica digital negatives. That was interesting. Yes. Yeah. I was not expecting that.
No, it's people who move between systems a lot, I'm always surprised by that. Because I have a one camera rule to try and keep my life simple.
Yeah.
So I just have my M. That was a kind of like a white whale camera. Before that, I'd used the Ricoh, which I think the GR, which I think was very similar color, like from a color perspective. I think they're probably closer than they are apart. And I'd used Sony before that. And the A7, the original A7 colors were kind of all over the shop. And I was never totally like won over by stuff like straight out of the camera there. But I think I've always felt like that's cheating a little bit, because I'm trying to document what's in front of me. So that's why I'm really interested in your approach of the colors, presumably for you, can be anything you want them. You can make them into whatever you want, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an artistic process for me.
Yeah.
And it will be different as I move forward with the Leica, simply because it's a totally different process. I mean, I get some of those images, like just regular snapshots when I'm out shooting in the mountains. I'm like, I don't even think I need to edit this. Like, this looks really good. Yeah. Whereas my Canon, I would just like throw everything everywhere and see what happened.
Yeah. It is nice to not have to fiddle with it. I have to say, like, because that's something you see when people are online. I saw something recently, made me chuckle, which was online. Someone was saying that Leica selling the Q2 for $6,000 or whatever they were selling it for, or the Q3, was an assault on customers. And, you know, they shouldn't do it. And I was sort of like, well, they're in the business of selling these to F1 drivers. Like, I don't think anyone's been harmed. I don't think someone is accidentally going, oh, I've got this Q3, I guess I won't feed my family for a few months.
I
think it's going to be okay.
It's a certain demographic.
I can see their point, but and there is, I suppose, it's too easy to sit and go, well, either A, there are two ends of the spectrum, which you just, there's too much noise around, probably, which is like, one is like, well, you can do anything with any camera if you want to. You can probably make any camera look like any other camera if you want to, like capable to shoot raw and off you go. And then I guess the other side to it is, if you have the means and you like the look of a certain camera, just buy that one. Yeah. In the same way that like Fuji's system does those wild film simulations, which are cool. Just, if you like those, just get those. Like, I feel like we need an arms around the world, come by our moment for photographers.
It's like, okay. Whatever you're shooting, it's okay.
Yeah. What if it was just fine?
Just have fun with whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
If it's not fun, why are you doing it? Well, I mean, obviously people do it for work, but
of course. But the tool's got to fit you. On the subject of your shiny new SL3, then, which can be a nice segue perhaps onto a lens.
Yeah, absolutely.
How are you finding the kind of, because it's a big hunky metal thing compared to, it's a very different approach to making a camera to some other makes, isn't it?
Shooting with the Canon R5, so it is it's about the same size, to be honest. It's a little heavier, there's a little more metal involved with the Leica SL3. I have one Canon lens left to sell. I've sold all of my Canon gear because I needed more lenses for the for the Leica, so it's time to create some income there to indulge that. But the process has been interesting switching over. It's a very different sort of interface. And I knew that R5 so well, I could use it with my eyes closed in the dark. Like, I just didn't even think about it. But what I did, what I thought was really, really cool with the SL3 is I went through and created different profiles for myself in that menu. Mm-hmm. So like a profile for Astro, a profile for self-portrait shooting with the intervalometer, a regular profile, a profile for wildlife if I'm out and there's a grizzly running out. So I'm excited to have all that. And then it's so customizable within each of those profiles. So different buttons that, or different functions that I'll know I'll use for, like, for instance, with Astro, I can set those buttons up and the dials up perfectly so that I don't have to think about it in the dark. And I'm excited about that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's nice. That was something I was going to ask you about, actually, when you were saying different settings for different things. Because you do seem to turn your hand to everything. And you seem to be one of those terribly annoying people who's like making beautiful images of animals, like the lion in the tree with the moon behind, like just the zebra and stuff.
Thank you.
Like, oh, just so cool. And, you know, I get red squirrels occasionally. It's not quite the same thing. But that, and then landscape, and then your art photography. I was going to ask whether there was any type of photography maybe that comes and goes, or that you loved at one time and maybe you've done it too much and it wanes now.
So wildlife is definitely, I don't consider myself a wildlife photographer. It's definitely a situational, Like if a really cool animal puts itself in front of me, am I going to take a photo? Absolutely. But I'm not going out. Like there's so many wildlife photographers here where I live, and they track wolves for years. And I don't have that sort of, you have to have a lot of patience to be a wildlife photographer. And I don't have that. And plus you can't boss the animals around to get them to sit perfectly in the frame. So that's annoying.
There was a huge coup. I feel like I'm going to say it was a few years ago and then probably find out it was like a decade ago. But the Wildlife Photographer of the Year, the British award that's in London every year, there was a big coup about that, about a wolf a few years ago. There was a photo of a wolf leaping over a gate. And I think it won. And it was, and there was a lot of like, well, to catch a wolf jumping a gate like that, they must have used a flash and they must have done certain things, and maybe that, and there was a suggestion they trained it, and it's like, well, I don't know if it matters. It's an incredible image.
I think wolves are pretty hard to train.
Yeah,
at least Canadian wolves.
I think it was in Germany. I want to say it was maybe in Germany somewhere. That was, if it wasn't the, it might have been, I'm definitely showing my age now, it might have been the year I got my first SLR, because I decided I was going to get one, and I went to the Wildlife Photographer of the Year Awards, and I looked, I couldn't decide between Nikon and Canon. So I looked at who had more, and there were more Nikon images that year in the finals than Canon.
So that's reason, what you buy?
Yeah, I bought a Nikon. Yeah. And I loved it. It was great. But yeah, a little D40, really good. Six megapixels.
Oh, wow.
Come a long way.
Megapixels. So far, yeah. Wow.
Six APS-C megapixels. Because the SL3 is what? Is that 60 as well?
It's 65 or 64, I think.
That's mental.
I don't do great with keeping those technical things in my brain, but
it also doesn't actually matter.
Yeah.
Like I shoot mine at 36 because it does the fun thing where you can kind of choose your image size effectively.
Okay.
So it's kind of three. So I just set it to the middle one because I'm not bothering the sides of buses or stadiums. Yeah, I think 36 megapixel image is probably probably enough latitude for a tourist.
For what you're doing,
Yeah, exactly. Ah. But yeah, so your first lens choice then potentially of your three, if you have a lens that's maybe like that you like, or a focal length that you gravitate towards. This is kind of the fun bit because often people come up with the formula.
Yeah, so yeah. Okay.
There are no rules.
So I with the camera that Leica gave me, it came with a 24-70 2.8, and which I've never used before. And so that was and I'm starting to really love it. Like next Monday, I'm flying in a helicopter out to a glacier to camp for the week. And that's the lens I'm going to use for the chopper. I think it'll be fantastic to get the peaks, and it's not so wide that I'll be getting the inside of the chopper, but I really like the versatility with that lens. I did just buy a used 90-280
2.8. Oh, wow.
And I got a fantastic price on it, and I love it so much.
Yeah.
Like I love it.
That'll be very cool.
Yeah. And
I love a lens like that. Be very nice. I think the M goes as high as 135.
Okay.
And then you've got to focus it with a rangefinder patch.
Right.
So good luck.
I've never shot with a rangefinder camera. I don't know what that would be like.
So initially, for me personally, it was very confusing. Initially, it was kind of a hard thing. Like it was funny. M shooters, I've got a few close friends who are M shooters, and they kind of rallied around. In a way, it was like when you let people know who've got children, you let people know you're also going to have children, and they sort of get around you and they go, right, okay, there's some stuff
we'll support you. It'll be
there's
okay.
Some stuff you need to know, and I think especially like for me, who's going to be a new, like I remember this when I was going to be a new dad, my mate Dave was like very like, right, okay, and we need to talk about some stuff. But yeah, so it was the same with the rangefinder. The focusing is so different, and you're looking off to one side, you're not looking through. I'd shot mirrorless for years, for like over a decade, or used point and shoots, which were showing you know, what you're going to get effectively through the screen. And so there is a definite difference to that. But what's really nice, and I think this is teaches us what it was like to shoot with film as well, is that you grow in confidence the less you're looking through a screen, because that what you were speaking to earlier about dialing your settings in and kind of nice. It's like the analogy I always do is like, you know, in the movies when people are really like cool assassins and they can dismantle a gun without looking at it and put it back together
right.
It's the nerdy image making version of that. Like if you can drive, that's why I like the M, because everything's on a switch. I think it's one of the reasons that the Fuji system's so popular as well, is the same sort of thing. Like the dials and stuff have been very consistent through versions. And so you can just dial in exactly what you want without really having to look at it. For me, a rangefinder camera is really nice because your aperture is on the bit that's attached to the lens. So when I'm thinking about like what looks through, it's like it's where you expect it. It's like the gear shift in a car is like, right, that's the gear thing and that's the indicator. So you've got a kind of button for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And there, and there's only really the three things you need to worry about. So it's quite, you know, I'll let myself auto ISO drive. And then actually a rangefinder patch, because it's a window to the world and your eye is really good at adjusting for low light.
Mm-hmm.
There's something nice about that, that it just adapts to the light conditions. You never have to kind of have that moment of switching, especially as I get older, my eyes are not as maybe as great as they were.
It changes, doesn't it?
It's just happening to me.
In a very real way. I didn't really expect that. Mm. And I've been wearing like reading glasses now for a few months, and I've noticed in low light, I've become one of those annoying people in restaurants who are like, why is it so dark in here? I can't see anything.
I'm taking things over to a window now in a way that I didn't. Like the office where I'm doing this, I have three windows. I have a window on my right and then two in front of me, and it's great for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know what you mean. It's my friend who's a few years older than me warned me this would happen. And I went, oh, no, James, I think you'll find I'm never going to age. And my hair color will definitely tell you otherwise. But yeah, but that is nice rather than looking at a screen, looking through a little window that's actually got light in it and frame lines.
I always find looking through the viewfinder a deeper sense of what I'm shooting when I'm looking through the viewfinder.
Yeah. Raising it, I think the other thing that's fun about rangefinder cameras is that they're small. So your camera looks like a child's drawing of a camera, right? It's like it's quite big.
Yeah, it's quite large.
But it's what people think cameras look like.
Right.
And what's nice about the M's and the Fuji systems is that like they're small and people don't really, you know. So if you're trying to take documentary style photos, or maybe you're at a family event or something like that, people assume either that you're shooting film or that what you're shooting can't possibly be used for anything because that looks like it's ancient or, you know, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, walk around on the street and sit it under a jacket. I'm always amazed when people use cameras like SLRs and DSLRs for street. And, you know, they run around. Sometimes they'll run around with like a medium format and they'll use them for street photography. I'm just like, that must be, you're making a statement.
Yeah. That's such a good point. When I had a little Fuji at one point when I was kind of in, I used to travel in a little more sensitive areas and I didn't want to have a big kind of conspicuous camera. But I've since given it to my daughter. So I have to figure out a solution for when I'm traveling in areas where I don't necessarily want to be advertising that I have quite that much year on.
Yeah. That is the downside. Like a guy in San Francisco at the Leica store showed me a trick for like putting your camera across your body under a jacket, because I quite like to wear a jacket sort of loose, like a canvasy jacket or something. Mm-hmm. And he was like, and then basically you can wear it across and sort of sling it on your like under your jacket. And again, it's like if you have a small camera with small lenses, so like I tend to run around with a 35 prime, it's quite small, just sits under there. My size 35-28 just hides away, and then you just pull it and get a photo and get on with your day. I met some proper little gangster street photographers when I was in San Francisco last, actually.
Okay.
Running around with rangefinders. They were shooting film. They meant it. Wow. I'll send you a picture of them afterwards. They let me get a portrait of like the four of them together. And if you look at them, it's like, I feel like I photographed like the next Joel Meyerowitz or something like that, like an inadvertent.
Oh, that's really cool. I feel
they were so cool. And they were just on this really busy corner near the Moscone. There's like a Trader Joe's on the corner as you walk down. And yeah, they were there. And I'd been at meetings, and then I'd ended one meeting with a beer. And I'll be honest, I was a little tipsy. And I wandered up to them because they were with their M, and I was just like, wow, is that an M? And they went, yeah. And we had a lovely little chat. It was great.
Really, oh, that's nice. So cool.
And then they told me not to have my camera out in San Fran. They were like, hide it away.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing about like a culture that I've been introduced to is there's a lot of street photography and I'm not necessarily exposed to that just geographically in Canada. There's not a lot of street photographers. So that's been kind of a new area to be exposed to. Mm. And it's interesting. Yeah. Genre I don't shoot a lot of, is street photography.
You've got so many big wide open spaces. I guess it just doesn't really attract it. Like, why would you be looking in there when you could be looking out there?
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe we don't have quite the beautiful cities and people in Calgary or in Canada can be just bundled up all the time. And I don't know if we're very interested. Maybe we might be boring. That's why.
Well, I've visited Vancouver. I have some friends there. I visited them before they got married a while ago. Yes, it was a stunning place to visit. Mm-hmm. And I did take lots of photos there with my Nikon while I was there.
Okay.
I still have those somewhere, squirreled away, probably in Flickr somewhere, because it was 2008, I think.
Right. So how long have you been shooting for?
So I probably started shooting properly. It was 2007, I think I bought my first. I decided I was going to, up until that point, Canon Ixus, little point and shoot, taking lots of photos. I'd always grown up around photos. My dad was really keen on photography. He was photojournalist in the loosest sense. Like he would, in his retirement, he basically made beer money by wandering around and taking photos. And because you can, when you're retired, just have a camera in the car, end up talking to someone and then make a story out of the person you met who turns out
you have that brewery kind of time. Or
and he would just find it and then he would sell them for £100 to a local newspaper or a local magazine. And he was it's funny because when I was looking at your stuff and you were talking about like the Leica prize and you have to write something and have the images, and it's quite a lot of work to pull it all together.
Yeah.
He was that in a really small way, like all the time. He's just like, if you're solving someone's problem fundamentally, then you're going to be successful. So he had the words, he had the pictures, he could rock up and he's giving it to a news desk and he's like, there you go. And also had the added bonus of being in his late 70s and early 80s, which is just hilarious that this dude turns up and he's just very chatty. So, but yeah, so I've been shooting 17 or so years, 18 years, something like that.
Okay.
Trying to be good at it probably for the last 10, like wanted to be good at it, wanted to understand it. So that's why I find, and it's not my day job, so I find that I love talking to people who get to do it for their day job and hear about
that's very cool.
Do you remember your first camera and when you first picked one up? Did you grow up around it? Or?
I didn't really grow up around cameras. No, I grew up in the bush in northern Canada, and so I was very isolated. And I think my parents maybe had a camera, but I didn't grow up around it, is what I'm saying. And then I knew I really liked photography, and I was gifted a Canon, I think, a year or two after my first baby. And so I was taking pictures of just the kids, like just as a hobby thing. I look at all the photos now and they're not bad. Like I had an eye for composition for sure, but it's like lowest res JPEG and So, and then when I turned 40, and my kids were both a lot more independent, I had purchased a Canon DSLR and I decided that I was going to learn how to take photos of the stars. I didn't know how to use it. I didn't know what to do with it. And so I think it was in 2019, I went out into Banff and just took this workshop, this 2-night workshop. And so I've been shooting, I guess, since early 2020. And that's nice. Since then I moved from that Canon is a 5D something to the R5 and now this camera. So I've had 3 cameras total.
Nice. And 2 of them mirrorless as well, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
And one of the first people I've spoken to who, like me, also really came up through digital. There's not really a lot of kind of, because there's sometimes a lot of hand wringing over whether we should be shooting film and things like that. And I'm also unburdened by that, really.
That is not something I think about.
No, it's nice here, not having to develop and send things
away. It's fun. It's so fun. And you can have such control over your files and I don't think about it.
No. I do allow myself instant photography. I will say instant film is still a magic trick and it's still lovely. And Polaroids hit hard. It's just they're like $3 a shot. And so it's just a bit like,
someone did give me an old refurbished Polaroid and sometimes I pull it out. Yeah. It's cute.
Yeah, they're really fun. Is it one of the little box?
It's like blue ones? And it's quite large, actually, and the picture comes out the front.
Oh, neat. Yeah.
Mostly when we're drinking out at the cabin, then I take out the Polaroid.
Yes, but they're perfect for stuff like that. They have a genius ad campaign. I was talking to a New York photographer named Sissy Liu a couple of weeks ago, and she's doing some stuff with them at the moment. And she's been given the brief, which is around they're in pursuit of imperfectionists. That's what they want. And I was like, that's very good.
That's clever.
That's leaning into the fact that, you know, because they're so sensitive to temperature and light and just everything that just you really have to get it right. But their newish, the i2, the Polaroid camera they've just released, which is fully manual. I think it's the first time that there's an out-of-the-box fully manual Polaroid camera. And it's mega. It's really, really great. It's got a beautiful lens. The being able to dial in the settings and stuff yourself and just choose what you're exposing for and just having that level.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's really nice. I think a $600 Polaroid camera is a sort of specific weapon for a specific person.
Yeah.
But
wow.
it's the best one of those. It's you know, well, and actually Leica did an instant. They do the instant now, the Sofort too. But when the original Sofort came out, my wife bought me one. I tell this story too often on the podcast, so apologies to listeners. But she bought it me as a joke because she was like, this is the only Leica you'll ever have. Ha, ha, ha. Because at that point, I was saving up for a queue and I would get close to kind of be able to afford it. And then I'd talk myself out of it because it was a lot of money. But that is an example of where you put instant film in a camera that's just a little bit better. In some ways, like maybe a slightly better lens or, you know, some slightly more control over your exposure. And suddenly it makes Instax film look incredible.
And so are you using Instax film in that like a, okay.
Yeah.
And do you use that quite a bit?
Yeah, the so far, I mean, it's a high days and holidays camera, you know, like it's like you saying like at the cabin, you know, it's a fun one to take out, but it makes lovely images. It makes really, really nice pictures. They don't do a pure analog one anymore.
Okay.
The Sofort 2 is it's a bit of a cheat because it's a printer inside a camera body, effectively.
Okay.
So they're kind of cheating a little bit. It's a 5-megapixel digital camera that then
has a printer on the inside.
Yeah, and if you crank the little lever, it prints one out. And you can also print pictures from your phone and stuff like that. So I have one to give to my neighbor of a squirrel was sunbathing on her bench recently.
Gotcha.
So you can print from, it's very versatile. Like it's the most affordable Leica there is. And it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But it's not the same as pure analog does have a kind of a texture to it.
A feel to it.
I noticed on the subject of pure analog and pictures, you've got a printer behind you. Like, are you printing? When did printing come into your, there it is. Where did that come in? Because that's a serious printer. Like you.
Yeah, and this I got a friend was selling this. They bought it and they hadn't used it, so I was like, I'll take it off your hands and learn how to print. It's frustrating to get the color rendering correct. So I'm still. It's a thing in progress.
Yeah,
I have not mastered printing yet, and I work with a great printer here in Calgary who does fantastic work. So it's like a little side hobby with all the time that I have.
Yeah, because you've covered a lot of ground. Exactly. Yeah. We're both with time.
In 4 years.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
I covered a lot of ground. Age. Yeah, I'm 46.
Yeah. I'm 45, so basically the same age. But yeah, because I started printing the thing under the cover behind me. There is my ProGraph as well. Same thing, and I've definitely enjoyed using it and dabbled. But the prints are gradually getting larger as I gradually develop the confidence. But I first printed something that was even A4 size. I think there was a moment where I was like, you look at it on the screen, you're like, this is a cool photo. This is going to look great.
This is going to look so good.
Yeah,
I'm
going
to frame this and put it in my house and everyone's going to say, wow, where did that come from?
Uh-huh. And you're going to go, it's not even IKEA. That's actually mine. But then I found the first things I printed, all I could see was the things that I kind of missed because it was a different feeling to have it in physical space. Did you have the same experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I was printing an image of a cheetah from the trip to Tanzania that we did in December and January. And I printed it out. I loved it on the screen. Like, it looked fantastic. I was like, this is it. This is going to be like my wildlife photo. And I printed it out and I was like, why is the cheetah so green? Like, when did that happen? Mm. Why is this color rendering so disgusting? Like,
Oh no.
I don't know.
No, so. I don't know. There's a world of pain in color calibrating screens and matching to printers. Not to mention printers are such a lower dynamic range than the screens and sensors we're getting used to. It's kind of.
Yeah. I think our eye is so spoiled by what we see on our camera and on our screens that when we're looking at an actual, I mean, I love looking at images printed out. I think that's how we should be looking at them.
Yeah.
But we get so used to these certain types of colors on computers and on screens and we're not seeing them printed out. And then we think something's wrong. And it's like, no, we're just used to these hyper saturated images, right?
Yeah, on HDR screens. Whilst we continue to check in, like with I feel like this is all partly therapy as well. Two photographers checking in on each other. Like, how's your photo book habit going? Have you gone down that rabbit hole yet?
No.
Okay.
No. I need to make some photo books. I'm just trying to figure my life out.
Fair enough. It feels like it's on the list. You're like, okay,
it's
Brian,
on the list. Yes,
I can get and to I'm. This.
You know, there's like updating the website, networking with galleries, putting together shows, making photo books, trying to figure out, like, there's just so much stuff.
Yeah. It's a difference, isn't it? Between like, presumably your friends who aren't photographers assume that your job is just going out every day and taking photos.
Yeah. Like, it's so easy. Yeah. But you have to become like a graphic designer and you have to know how to write and marketing and. There's so many things.
I've fallen down the rabbit hole recently of other people's photo books. I'm not making very many like printed things. I'm printing some images, but yeah, I'm definitely getting into a bad habit of, I'll buy that Saul Leiter book, which I'll look at all the time and it's still on the shelf and I haven't opened it just yet. But
So you're asking like how many photo books do I have?
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about making my own.
No, but it was interesting.
I recently just purchased a couple more. Yeah. I'm looking at my shelves in the back there.
Right. There we go.
I have perhaps more photo books, than I have time to read or absorb.
Oh, good.
So I'm part of the support group now. Thanks.
Yes. No, that's good. That's good. The Kiwis have a phrase, go hard or go home. And I think you just embrace that with every aspect of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it, do you think, early on that made you want to pick it up as a gig then? Because if you started kind of picking up cameras and enjoying image making, and the reason I'm asking this is because it's quite common in people I speak to that one day they just decide. And I love that. Like one day because obviously there's a creative aspect to it and there's an enjoyment to kind of like making something with your hands and a craft. But it feels like there's also an element always of like, I'll show you I can do this. I've got this is in my head. I'm going to make you look at it. And I quite like that. It's a little bit.
Yeah.
Was that kind of how it was maybe a little bit for you?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. Absolutely. After I learned how to use my camera in the dark, I just decided that this was what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And I just threw myself into it 100%. And it's all I did. So on backcountry skiing trips out for 5 days in the mountains, everyone had their gear and I had my gear and a camera and people would just have to get used to me hauling out my camera and being like, okay, so I'm shooting now, ski along. And you get used to being the annoying one who's constantly asking to stop the group. But it became a very real thing pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I love it when people fall in love with hobbies so fast and it becomes like, no, this isn't just a hobby anymore. This is something like, I was meant to do.
Yeah. I don't want to, the word obsession has weird connotations to it, but it definitely became something that, it is absolutely my creative outlet. And I maybe could have gone with something else, but this is what I'm going to do. This is what I want to do. This is what feels right. So let's just go.
Yeah. No, I love that. Yeah. I asked a photographer, Tiffany Roubert, who I interviewed last week. She shoots on film because she's a mad woman. But she was saying, I was asking her, because a lot of her portraiture and photos are very, like, groups of friends. It's quite intimate and close. And I was like, you know, how do people feel about that? And she just answered in a wonderfully sort of French way, which is just like, well, if you're with me, this is just what's going to happen. Yeah. And I love that because I I don't have that bravery outside of my family. And she's just like, no, I've got a camera. I'm going to make images.
People like it, actually, I find. Mm. Like, once they get used to, like in my situation, once your friends get used to you slowing them down a little bit, they like having the record of what we did. And they appreciate it. So they start to indulge it a little bit.
Yeah. Especially when it's done by someone who's capable. I feel sometimes you have to win people over, you know, as well. Like, you have to show them that it's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
I joke with the boys when my boys are sick of photos. I go, look, I'm making your childhood look magical.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to appreciate this. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. It's going to be okay, guys. You look great. But yeah. I was assuming that problem would go away over time, but actually, as they become teenagers, I guess that just becomes more prevalent. Like, don't.
Yeah, you won't be shooting them when they're teenagers.
No.
Get it in while you can, because the moment they turn like 12, they're done with you putting a camera.
Is that what the 90s to 80s for? Stand a long way back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they have no patience for you.
No.
When they're teenagers.
How much are you traveling for work then now? If you've gone through a period of, I guess, being hit up, like I sort of contacted you for interviews and stuff like that. Like, presumably you're going through a really busy media period, like you're saying, talking to galleries and relationships and stuff. Does that see you having to travel around a lot, or has everyone changed post-pandemic? Is it all this? You know?
Well, I didn't shoot really before the pandemic, so I don't really have anything to compare to. But I was in New York in June with Leica. They brought me to New York to speak at Photoville on a panel. So that was really fantastic. I loved that. Mm-hmm. During the summer, I mostly try to hang out here in the mountains and just do some big trips into the mountains, like the one I was referring to on Monday. And Canada is really beautiful in the summer, so definitely stay here. Yeah. In my dream world, eventually I'll make connections with a gallery in Europe or something and, make that happen and travel there. At this point, I don't have as much travel scheduled. I am, however, going to Bolivia in January on a photography expedition for almost 3 weeks, I think. So I'm very excited to get in that brand new or new to me scenery and see what I can create there.
Oh, that'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Seeing new places is always fun. It's very refreshing, isn't it?
Like, it's refreshing and it's inspiring to kind of have this new palette to create with.
Yeah. Where I live in the Highlands, we are surrounded by trees. Like, literally, our house is surrounded by trees. And so I photographed a lot of trees. And then recently I was traveling to the US and I was looking forward to it was for work, but I was just looking forward to the opportunity to take photos of things that weren't trees. It was going to be quite nice. Like, right, there's going to be some hard lines and shapes and shadows and just different faces. You know?
And did you get what you wanted or what you were hoping for?
Yeah, I did. Well, I traveled. I've done so much travel recently, and I was in Crete as well. And the light there was astonishing.
Oh, that's amazing.
It fills every frame in a way that just the light in Scotland. I mean, I'm looking up now, there's actual sun and sky, but the light here often is grey cloud, which basically is like a giant softbox over the world. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to my friend Mel, who's on an earlier episode of the podcast about this, because she's from Australia originally, and there you learn to shoot a lot with a flash because the light is so harsh that you need to fill subjects to kind of balance. You can't, if you've got shadow, you're either using the shadow to be a really, really sharp contrast, because like it's just blue skies, hot and sunny, there's no escape from
right.
the sun.
So
it was interesting to kind of just shoot in very different conditions, and Crete was like that, where the light was astonishing, especially at sunset, just the pinks and the oranges.
Yeah.
It was very, very salmon colored, whereas sunset here tends to be a bit more orange. I think I'm thinking recently, because we moved here a year ago from lower down in Britain,
okay.
so like in North Yorkshire. Yeah. And I think your angle on the globe affects the angle of the light, I think, affects
I think so.
The way that sunsets and stuff work. Or at least that's my working theory, because the sunsets here are just different. They just hit different. The sky colors are different.
Right.
And Crete was that again when we were there. So, but yeah, I've been to Sweden and the US and Greece this year for various work and family commitments.
And are you shooting in all those places?
Yeah. Yeah. The camera, my camera is with me all the time.
Wonderful.
The M just comes everywhere. And
yeah.
I have a little 35 Zeiss that I like because it's small. It's only an F2.8. I say only, but I like it. That's my trade-off for me. Like the some of the Sumilux lenses that Leica make are, especially for the M, I mean, they're small by comparison to like an L mount lens, but the M mount kind of teeny tiny lenses, they start to get a bit longer. You get
right.
50 mil lenses that are sort of similar size to a 90, and they're heavy, and they
right.
you know, you, so it's a question then of, do I need to go down to 1.4, or actually, if you're focusing with a rangefinder patch and you're focusing, maybe it's like, do I, you know, sometimes something needs to be in focus, and maybe I'm not doing a portrait on a tripod. I'm sort of finding scenes that I like, finding textures and things like that. But but that will change. I've got a project I'm sort of working on putting together at the moment, so that's exciting. Will probably change. Yeah, it's going to put me right out of my comfort zone, which is quite good.
That'll be a really cool project. How long are you thinking that's going to kind of go on for?
Well, could be. So here's the thing. Video games are a very secretive industry. And so I'm going to have to get in first instance. And I'm going to have to like earn people's trust and kind of show that I'm good for it. I'm going to have to find studios that would let me do it. I'm going to have to find ways to get there, because I don't know where in the world they will be.
So it could be quite a process.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I'm thinking I'll probably start with portraits and sort of ask if I can make a series of portraits of people. And that's the bit that will push me probably most out of my comfort zone, because I don't tend to pause and get a portrait of someone and try and develop. So that's a totally new skill that I'm going to
have to
learn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
We'll check in again in about 10 years when I think, because it could be that long. It could be.
No, I don't think it'll take that long. You'll be great.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. Well, and plus games take that long to make sometimes. So
yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. Even 10 years ago, we used to talk about a game that took 3 years being ages, and now they will routinely take 4. You know, they're just so complex. There's so many people involved in making them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they've certainly come a long way since like the Sega Genesis of the 90s. Yes.
Yeah. We were playing Bomberman 94 tonight as a family. Time, which it struck me how old that is, because the year is in the title.
Yeah.
I can't know.
Do your sons like video games?
They do. I'm afraid because I'm the guy that pedals crack, and I sort of, I've made them love it. But they also love photography, which is really nice.
Oh,
so
good.
There is a Venn diagram overlap of like things I like that they like, and
my
youngest really, he has an old Fuji that he really loves shooting with. So we play a lot of games, and we take a lot of photos, and it's really nice. I hope some of it sticks. I hope I mean, the video games probably will, right? They do just love them, and their friends play them. I'm hoping that like photography, and I love MotoGP and sport and things, so I'm hoping that they carry some of those. Do you think any of yours are going to pick up a camera now that you're in it?
Youngest daughter, my 14-year-old, she has my old Fuji, my old little Fuji that she is using, and she likes it. It's not quite as simple as just using her iPhone camera, so. Yeah. That's a little more frustrating for her, I think, but they're both, my daughters are pretty artistic. One paints and one likes to take photos. So
amazing.
That's great. Yeah.
No, that's really nice. It's the gift we can give them, I hope, is just exposing them to different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And letting them know that creativity is in all of us, and we just have to figure out how to express it, what way feels best for us to express it. So
To get those little wins, that feeling of I made this,
and exactly,
and share it some way. No, it's lovely. Oh, brilliant. Well, that seems like a lovely sort of point to wrap it up and end it on, really. I didn't get to asking what an Enemo bar is, but
A Nanaimo bar. Oh, Nanaimo. I can tell you about that.
Yeah, because that was like a fascinating ice cream. I was just,
Nanaimo bars are fantastic. So they're like a little chocolatey base, usually with walnuts, maybe sometimes coconut in the chocolate base.
Oh, okay.
Like a brownie base, kind of brownie texture, but maybe a little more dense. And then there's a yellow custard in between. Believe it's called like bird's custard or something.
Yes.
And then along top is a thin layer of just pure chocolate. And it is the most Canadian of desserts besides butter tarts, which are also delicious. Nice. And everyone in Canada is quite passionate about Nanaimo bars.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
I love
They're
that
so
I
mispronounced
it as well. That's great. The bird's custard is key. My granddad instilled in me at a young age a total love of bird's custard.
So good.
It's tremendous.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Oh, really?
I have to kind of sneak it in occasionally. It's really nice. And she's like, rhubarb crumble or something like that, like the tartness of the rhubarb and then the sweetness of the custard on top.
Yeah, and one thing about Nanaimo bars, they're very sweet. So unless you really want to feel like you're flying to the moon, you got to have small doses.
Okay. Are they served then as like a big dessert and you cut bits off?
Yeah.
Is that how? Yeah. Okay.
So like a big
I was imagining
sheet.
It was like a Snickers or something, but that's...
No, it's like a layered thing and then you cut it into bars.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay.
That's on the list. I'm going to look at the recipe.
Yeah. I love to cook, you should definitely make some and then tell me how they turn out.
Yes. Well, you will definitely get bombarded with my awful monstrosity. It'd be like when I learned pizza during the pandemic. And you can see these all, as they progress to being actually acceptable looking food.
Oh, that's funny.
The early ones. Oh, mate, I was looking. They are 5 years ago. They show up. I use a diary app and it shows me pictures from like this day in the past.
Yeah.
And the pizza I made, I think 5 or 6 years ago today, I wouldn't serve anyone now.
Just, we all start
so
somewhere.
Proud of it. Yeah,
whether it's so photos or pizza, we all start somewhere.
We do. Brilliant. Oh, well, thanks so much, Stasia. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah,
that was a lovely conversation.
That was fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to point anyone anywhere before we sign off?
Oh, sure. I have my website, stasiaschmidt.com. My Instagram, stasia.schmidt, I think is my Instagram handle. And then I have a Substack. I think it's just Stasia Schmidt. I don't remember.
Makes you easy to find. I'm the same. I'm Ian Farrell everywhere.
Yeah. Keep it simple. Yeah.
Exactly. Cool. All right. Well, have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you. You as well, Ian. We'll talk
Thanks
soon.
Take care. Bye.
Ciao.
Thanks again to Stasia for taking the time to talk there. That was a good one. I enjoyed that. Lots of printing chat. Very nice. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. If you haven't already, you can subscribe on Apple Podcast or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. There's links in the show notes for that. And you can sign up for a newsletter if you want to find out more about some of the topics we touched on. I do a weekly newsletter on a Wednesday that has links to things we talk about in the previous episode. And there's a little reminder in case you haven't listened to it yet. It's all very good. If you like the show, hit us with a 5-star review, tell a friend, send me an email. I love to hear from listeners. It's really nice. That'll do then. Have a great week. And let's do this again next week. It was fun. See you later.